the wobble frequency and light mask, they learned that the planet was quite close to its parent star. At first, this discovery did not attract too much attention, because the astronomy community had by then discovered more than 200 planetary systems. But further observations revealed a shocking fact. The distance between planet and star was continually shrinking, and the rate of shrinkage was accelerating. This meant that humanity would, for the first time, observe a planet falling into a star. 1 year later, or rather 84 years prior to observation, it happened. Observational conditions at the time meant that the collision could only be determined based on the gravitational wobble and the periodic light mask. But then, something wondrous happened. A spiral of matter appeared around the star, and this spiral flow continued to expand. It looked like a mainspring slowly unwinding with the star as its center. Cosmo and his colleagues realized that the material flow had been ejected from the planet's crash point. The chunk of rock had crashed through the shell of that distant sun and ejected its stellar matter into space, where, due to the star's own rotation, it formed a spiral. There were several key pieces of data here, sir. The star is a yellow G2 class with an absolute magnitude of 4.3 and a diameter of 1.2 million kilometers, quite similar to our Sun. The planet was about 4% of the mass of Earth, or a little smaller than Mercury, and the spiral cloud of material produced from the collision had a radius of up to 3 AU, more than the distance between our Sun and the asteroid belt. And it was in this discovery that I found the crack with which to break open your real strategic plan. Now, as your wall breaker, I will explain your grand strategy. Supposing that you are ultimately able to obtain those million or more stellar hydrogen bombs, you will, as you promised to the PDC, stockpile them all from Mercury. If the bombs are detonated in the rock of Mercury, they'll be like a turbo engine decelerating the planet. Eventually its speed will no longer be able to keep it in low orbit, and it will fall into the Sun. Next, what happened on 275E1, 84 light-years away, is reenacted here. Mercury punctures the Sun's convective shell and ejects a huge amount of stellar matter from its radiation layer into space at high speed, which, as the Sun rotates, forms a spiral atmosphere similar to that in 275E1. The Sun differs from the Trisolaran system in that, as a lone star, it will never cross paths with another star, and therefore its atmosphere will continue to increase uninhibited until it becomes even thicker than the atmosphere of those stars. This was also confirmed by observations of 275E1. When the spiral flow of ejected matter expands outward from the Sun like an unwound mainspring, its thickness eventually passes Mars orbit, at which point a magnificent chain reaction begins. First, three terrestrial planets, Venus, Earth, and Mars, pass through the Sun's spiraling atmosphere, losing speed due to the atmospheric friction, and turning into three giant meteors that eventually crash into the Sun. But well before this happens, the Earth's atmosphere is stripped away by the intense friction of the solar matter. The oceans evaporate, and the lost atmosphere and evaporated oceans turn the Earth into a giant comet whose tail extends along its orbit to wrap all the way around the Sun. The surface of the Earth returns to the fiery magma sea of its birth, where no life can survive. When Venus, Earth, and Mars crash into the Sun, it exacerbates the Sun's ejection of solar matter into space. The single spiral flow of matter increases to four flows. Because the total mass of those three planets is 40 times that of Mercury, and because their higher orbits mean they impact the Sun at a much higher speed, each new spiral is ejected with a ferocity tens of times greater than Mercury's. The existing spiral atmosphere rapidly expands until its edge approaches the orbit of Jupiter. Friction produces only a very small deceleration effect on the huge mass of Jupiter, so it is quite some time before the spiral has a noticeable effect on Jupiter's orbit. But Jupiter's satellites meet one of the following two fates. Friction strips them away from Jupiter, and they lose speed and fall into the Sun, or they lose speed in Jovian orbit and fall into the liquid planet. As the chain reaction continues, the decrease in speed from the spiral atmosphere, though small, is still present, and Jupiter's orbit gradually decays. This causes it to pass through an increasingly dense atmosphere, whose friction accelerates its loss in speed, thereby causing the orbit to decay even more quickly. In this way, Jupiter eventually falls into the Sun too. Its mass is 600 times that of the previous four planets, and the impact that such a massive body makes on the Sun will, even according to the most conservative reasoning, produce an even more violent ejection of stellar matter, increasing the density of the spiral atmosphere and exacerbating the bitter cold of Uranus and Neptune. But another possibility is more likely. The fall of the Jovian giant pushes the edge of the spiral atmosphere out to the orbit of Uranus or even Neptune, and though the atmosphere is quite thin at the top, friction's decelerating effects pull these two planets and their satellites toward the Sun too. What state the Sun will be in, and how the solar system will have been transformed after the chain reaction finishes, and the four dense terrestrial planets and four gas giants are consumed, is unknowable. But one thing is certain. For life and for civilization, this will be a hell even crueler than attack by Trisolaris. As for Trisolaris, the solar system is their only hope before their planet is engulfed by their stars. There is no other world they can migrate to in time, and therefore, their civilization will follow humanity into total destruction. This is your strategy. Death for both sides. Once everything is prepared, with all of the stellar hydrogen bombs in place on Mercury, you will use it to coerce Trisolaris to surrender and gain the ultimate victory for humanity. What I've just presented is the outcome of the years of work that I, your wall-breaker, have performed. I am not seeking your opinion or critique, because I know that all of this is true. As the wall-breaker spoke, Ray Diaz had been listening quietly. The cigar in his hand was more than halfway gone, and he now turned it about, as if appreciating the glow of the tip. The wall-breaker sat down on the sofa, close beside him. Like a teacher evaluating a student's homework, he continued unfatigued. "Mr. Ray Diaz, I said you are a brilliant strategist, or at least you demonstrated many excellent qualities in the formulation and implementation of this plan. For one thing, you took advantage of your own background. Right now, people clearly remember the humiliations you and your country suffered when the Orinoco nuclear facility was forced to be taken down as you were developing nuclear energy. The whole world saw your gloomy face, and you took advantage of outside perceptions of your paranoia about nuclear weapons to reduce or even eliminate any possible suspicion. But every detail in the execution of your plan demonstrates your talent as well. I will mention but one example. During the Mercury test, you wanted the rock to be blasted into the sky, but you insisted on excavating an ultra-deep shaft in a far-sighted gambit. You quite precisely understood the tolerance of the PDC's permanent member states for the cost of this enormous undertaking, and that is admirable. But you had one major slip-up. Why did the first test have to be carried out on Mercury? There would have been plenty of time to bring the bombs there in a later phase, but maybe you got impatient and wanted to see the outcome of a stellar hydrogen bomb blast there. You saw it. Lots of rock matter blasted to escape velocity, perhaps even exceeding your expectations. You were satisfied. But this provided the final confirmation of my hypothesis. Yes, Mr. Ray Diaz, even given all my previous work, without that final event, I might never have been able to determine your true strategic intentions. The notion was too mad, but it was grand, and even beautiful. If the chain reaction triggered by Mercury's fall actually took place, then it would be the most magnificent movement of the entire symphony of the solar system. Although, unfortunately, humanity would only be able to enjoy the first section. Mr. Ray Diaz, you are a wall-facer with the makings of a god. It is my honor to become your wall-breaker. The wall-breaker stood up and offered Ray Diaz a genial bow. Ray Diaz did not look at him. He took a puff of his cigar and blew out the smoke as he continued to examine it. Fine. Then I'll ask the question that Tyler asked. The wall-breaker asked the question for him. If what I say is true, then so what? Ray Diaz stared at the lit end of the cigar and nodded. My answer is the same as Tyler's wall-breaker's. The Lord does not care. Ray Diaz lifted his eyes from the cigar and looked questioningly at his wall-breaker. You look crude, but your mind is sharp. Yet in the depths of your soul, you're still crude. Your nature is that of a crude man, and this crudeness is revealed in the basis of this strategic plan. It's greedy. Humanity doesn't have the ability to manufacture so many stellar hydrogen bombs. Even if all of Earth's industrial resources were exhausted, it wouldn't produce even one-tenth of that number. And a million stellar hydrogen bombs is far from enough to decelerate Mercury into the sun. With a soldier's recklessness, you formulated this impossible plan, and then stubbornly carried it forward step by step with the wily calculations of a superior strategist. Wall-facer Ray Diaz, this is truly a tragedy. As Ray Diaz looked at the wall-breaker, his expression gradually filled with an elusive softness, and hints of convulsion showed on his coarsely lined face, gradually taking shape, until at last his suppressed laughter erupted. Ha 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 ha! He laughed, pointing at the wall-breaker. Superman! Ha 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 ha! I remember now. That old Superman. He could fly, and he could reverse the rotation of the Earth, but when he was riding a horse... he fell and broke his neck. Ha 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 ha! It was Christopher Reeve, the actor who played Superman, who fell and broke his neck. The wall-breaker corrected him, quietly. Do you imagine? Imagine that your fate will be better than his! Ha 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 ha! Since coming here, I have no regard for my fate. I've lived a full life, the wall-breaker said evenly. But you, Mr. Ray Diaz, ought to think about your own fate. You'll die first, Ray Diaz said, smiling with his entire face as he pressed the cigar end directly between the wall-breaker's eyes. Then, when the wall breaker was covering his face with his hands. Ray Diaz took up a military-issue belt from the sofa, wrapped it around the wall breaker's neck, and strangled him with every ounce of his strength. Although the wall breaker was young, he had no way to defend himself against Ray Diaz's agile strength, and was thrown to the floor by his neck. Ray Diaz bellowed,
"I'll wring your neck, you bastard! Who sent you here to play smart? Who the hell are you? Bastard! I'll wring your neck!"
He tightened the belt and slammed the wall breaker's head into the ground repeatedly, to the crunch of teeth smacking into the floor. When the guards burst in to separate them, the wall breaker's face was purple, he was foaming at the mouth, and his eyes were protruding like a goldfish's. Ray Diaz, still in a fury, struggled with the guards as he continued to shout,
"Wring his neck! String him up and hang him! Right now! This is part of the plan! Do you fucking hear me? Part of the plan!"
But the three guards did not carry out his order. One of them held Ray Diaz tightly, while the other two lifted up the wall breaker, who had recovered his breath somewhat, and started to carry him out.
"Just wait, you bastard! You won't die easy," he said,
abandoning his efforts to escape the guard and have another go at the wall breaker. He let out a long sigh. The wall breaker looked back over the guard's shoulder, a smile on his bruised and swollen face. He opened up a mouth that was missing several teeth and said,
"I've lived a full life."
PDC Wallfacer Hearing. As the meeting commenced, the United States, United Kingdom, France, and Germany put up another proposition. This one demanding the immediate suspension of Ray Diaz's position as wallfacer and his trial before the International Court of Justice for crimes against humanity. The U.S. representative declared,
"After substantial investigation, we believe that Ray Diaz's strategic intent as disclosed by the wallbreaker is credible. What we are facing now is a person whose crime dwarfs all of the crimes ever committed in human history. We were unable to find a single law applicable to his crime, so we recommend that the crime of extinction of life on Earth be added to international law, and that Ray Diaz be tried under it."
Ray Diaz appeared quite relaxed at the hearing. Sneering, he said to the U.S. representative,
"You've been trying to get rid of me, haven't you? Ever since the Wallfacer Project began, you have all applied a double standard to the Wallfacers. I'm the one you like least."
The UK representative retorted,
"Wallfacer Ray Diaz's claim is baseless. In fact, the countries he is accusing are the ones who invested the most money into his plan, far exceeding what they invested in the other three Wallfacers."
"Sure," Ray Diaz said with a nod. "But the real reason you invested so heavily in my plan is because you wanted to get your hands on the stellar hydrogen bombs."
"Ridiculous! What would we do with them?" the U.S. representative shot back. "They're incredibly inefficient weapons in a space battle, and on the Earth, there's no practical significance even for those old 20-megaton hydrogen bombs, much less a 300-megaton monster."
Ray Diaz responded calmly,
"But the bombs will be the most effective weapon in battles on other planets, particularly in wars among humans. On the desolate surface of other planets, there's no need to be concerned with civilian casualties or environmental damage, so you're free to carry out wide-area destruction, or even a devastating sweep of the entire surface. Here's where the stellar hydrogen bombs will prove useful. You must have anticipated that, as humanity expands into the solar system, Earth's conflicts will expand outward as well. This won't change, even with Tri-Solaris as a common enemy, and you're preparing for it. Right now, it's politically indefensible to develop superweapons for use against humans, so you took advantage of me to make them."
the U.S. representative said. That's the preposterous logic of a terrorist and a dictator. Ray Diaz is the kind of man who, granted the status and power of a wallfacer, turns the wallfacer project into as big a danger as the Trisolaran invasion. We must take decisive action to correct this mistake.
They're as good as their word,
Ray Diaz said, turning to Garanin, the incumbent rotating chair.
The CIA has men waiting outside to arrest me as soon as I go outside after this hearing.
The rotating chair glanced in the direction of the U.S. representative, who was fiddling intently with his pen. Garanin had first taken office at the start of the Wallfacer project, and even he had forgotten the number of short terms in office he had served during the ensuing 2 decades. But this was the last time. Now white-haired, he was about to retire.
Wallfacer Ray Diaz, if what you say is true, then that is inappropriate. So long as the principles of the Wallfacer project still hold, Wallfacers have legal immunity, and none of their words or actions can be used as evidence to charge them of a crime, he said.
Additionally, please remember that this is international territory,
the Japanese representative said. So does that mean, the U.S. representative said, raising a pencil, that even when Ray Diaz is about to detonate the million superbombs he's buried on Mercury, society still won't be able to charge him with a crime?
According to the relevant provisions in the Wallfacer Act, placing limitations and curbs on the strategic plans of Wallfacers who exhibit dangerous tendencies is an entirely separate matter from the Wallfacer's own legal immunity, Garanin said.
Ray Diaz's crimes have crossed outside the boundary of legal immunity. He must be punished. This is a precondition for the continued existence of the Wallfacer project, the UK representative said.
May I remind the chair and the representatives, Ray Diaz said, rising from his seat, that this is a PDC Wallfacer hearing, and that I'm not on trial.
You'll stand in court soon, the U.S. representative said, with a chilly smile.
I agree with Wallfacer Ray Diaz. We should return to the discussion of his strategic plan,
Garanin said, seizing the opportunity to temporarily bypass the thorny issue. The Japanese representative broke his silence.
From the way it looks now, the representatives have reached a consensus on the following point. Ray Diaz's strategic plan exhibits dangerous tendencies toward clear violations of human rights, and according to the relevant principles in the Wallfacer Act, it should be stopped.
Then Proposition P-269 proposed at the previous Wallfacer hearing regarding halting Ray Diaz's strategic plan can now be put to a vote,
Garanin said.
Mr. Chair, wait one moment.
Ray Diaz raised his hand.
Before the vote, I hope I might be able to offer a final explanation of some of the details of my plan.
If they are just details, is this really necessary?
Someone asked. Save it for court, the UK representative said sarcastically.
No, these details are important,
Ray Diaz persisted.
Right now, let us assume that what the Wallbreaker has disclosed about my strategic intentions is true. One representative spoke of the moment when the million hydrogen bombs deployed on Mercury are ready to be detonated, at which point I will face the omnipresent Sophons and declare to Trisolaris humanity's intent to die with them. What will happen then?
The Trisolaran's reaction can't be predicted, but on Earth, it's certain that billions of people will want to wring your neck, just like you did to that Wallbreaker,
the French representative said.
Exactly. So I took certain measures to deal with such a situation. Take a look at this.
Ray Diaz raised his left hand and displayed his wristwatch to the assembly. It was entirely black, and the dial was twice as large and thick as a normal men's watch, although it didn't appear large on his thick wrist.
"This is a transmitter, sending a signal through a space link directly to Mercury."
"You'll use it to send the detonation signal?"
someone asked.
"Precisely the opposite. It sends a non-detonation signal."
His words focused the attention of the entire assembly. He went on.
"The system is codenamed Cradle, meaning that when the cradle stops rocking, the baby will wake. It sends a continuous signal, received continuously on Mercury. If the signal is interrupted, then the system will immediately detonate the hydrogen bomb."
"It's called a dead man's switch," the U.S. representative said stoically. "In the Cold War, there was research into using anti-triggers and dead man switches on strategic nukes, but they were never implemented. Only a madman would actually do it." Ray Diaz brought down his left hand and covered the cradle with his sleeve.
"I was taught this wonderful idea, not by an expert in nuclear strategy, but by an American film. In it, a man has one of these gadgets that sends out a continuous signal, but if his heart stops beating, the signal is terminated. Another man has a bomb strapped to him that's impossible to remove, and if the bomb doesn't receive the signal, it'll explode. So even though this hapless fool doesn't like the first guy, he has to do everything he can to protect him. I like watching American blockbusters. Even today, I can still recognize the old version of Superman."
"Do you mean that this device is tied to your heartbeat?"
the Japanese representative asked. He reached over to Ray Diaz, who was standing next to him, to touch the device under his sleeve. But Ray Diaz moved his arm and stood a bit farther away.
"Of course. But the cradle is more advanced and refined than that. It monitors not just the heartbeat, but lots of other physiological indicators, such as blood pressure, body temperature, and so forth, and conducts a comprehensive analysis of these parameters. If they're not normal, then it immediately stops the anti-trigger signal in the dead man's switch. It can also recognize many of my simple voice commands."
A nervous-looking man entered the auditorium and whispered something into Garanine's ear. Before he had finished whispering, Garanine glanced up at Ray Diaz with a peculiar look in his eyes, which did not escape the keen-eyed representatives.
"There's a way to disarm your cradle. Countermeasures for anti-triggers were studied during the Cold War, too," the U.S. representative said.
"It's not my cradle. It's the cradle for those hydrogen bombs. If the cradle stops rocking, they'll wake up,"
Ray Diaz said.
"I've thought of the same technique," the German representative said. "When the signal is transmitted from your watch to Mercury, it must pass through a complicated communications link, destroying or shielding any node, then using a false signal source to continue to transmit the anti-trigger signal farther down the chain, will render your cradle system useless."
"That is indeed a problem,"
Ray Diaz said, with a nod at the German representative.
"Without the sophons, the problem is easily solved. All the nodes are loaded with an identical encryption algorithm that generates every signal sent. To the outside world, it looks as if the signal values are random and different every time. But the cradle's sender and recipient produce a sequence of values that are identical. Only when the recipient receives a signal corresponding to its own sequence is the signal considered valid. Without this encryption algorithm, the signal sent out by your false source won't match the recipient's sequence. But the damn sophons can detect the algorithm."
"You've perhaps come up with another approach?" someone asked.
"A crude approach. Me, all my approaches are clumsy and crude,"
Ray Diaz said, with a self-mocking laugh.
I have increased the sensitivity of each node's monitoring of its own state. Specifically, each communication node is composed of several units that may be separated by a large distance, but are connected into a whole by continuous communication. If any one unit fails, the entire node will issue a command terminating the anti-trigger, after which, even if the false signal source resumes sending a signal to the next node, it will not be acknowledged. The monitoring of every unit can achieve a microsecond level of accuracy, which means that, using the German representative's approach, every unit of a node must be simultaneously destroyed and the signal resumed from the false signal source within the space of a microsecond. Every node is composed of at least 3 units, but may have dozens of them. These units are separated by a distance of about 300 kilometers. Each one is built to be extremely rugged, and it will issue its warning upon any outside touch. Causing these units to fail within the space of a microsecond might be possible for the Trisolarans, but it's not currently possible for humans.
His final sentence put everyone on alert.
I have just received the report that the thing on Ray Diaz's wrist has been sending out an electromagnetic signal,
Garanin said. The atmosphere of the assembly turned tense at the news.
I'd like to ask you, Volfacer Ray Diaz, is the signal from your wristwatch being sent to Mercury?
Ray Diaz chuckled a few times, then said,
Why would I be sending it to Mercury? There's nothing there but a giant pit. Besides, the Cradle's space communication link hasn't been set up yet. No, no, no. You don't need to worry. The signal isn't going to Mercury. It's going somewhere in New York City, very close to us.
The air froze, and everyone in the assembly, apart from Ray Diaz, stood as shocked as wooden chickens.
If the signal sustaining the Cradle is terminated, what will it trigger?
The UK representative asked sharply, no longer attempting to mask his tension.
Oh, something will be triggered, all right,
Ray Diaz said to him with a broad laugh.
I've been a wall facer for more than 20 years, and I've always been able to get a few things of my own.
Well then, Mr. Ray Diaz, would you be able to answer an even more direct question?
The French representative said. He looked entirely calm, but there was a tremble in his voice.
How many lives will you, or will we, be responsible for?
Ray Diaz widened his eyes at the Frenchman, as if he thought the question bizarre.
What? The number of people makes a difference? I thought all of you here were respectable gentlemen who prize human rights above all. What's the difference between one life and 8.2 million? If it's the former, then you don't have to respect it?
The U.S. representative stood up and said,
More than 20 years ago when the Wallfacer project began, we pointed out what he was.
Pointing a finger at Ray Diaz and spraying saliva as he spoke, he strove to contain himself, but ended up losing control.
He's a terrorist! An evil, filthy terrorist! A devil! You unstop the bottle and let him loose, and you must take responsibility! The UN must be held responsible!
He shouted hysterically, sending his papers flying.
Calm down, Mr. Representative,
Ray Diaz said with a slight smile.
The Cradle is very sensitive to my physiological indices. If I were to go into hysterics like you, if my mood wavered, it would immediately stop sending the anti-trigger signal. So you, and all of you sitting here, shouldn't make me too upset. It would be better for all of us if you could try and keep me happy.
What are your conditions?
Garanin asked softly. A bit of sadness crept into the smile on Ray Diaz's face as he turned toward Garanin and shook his head.
Mr. Chair, what other conditions could I name? To leave here and return to my own country. A charter plane is waiting for me at Kennedy Airport.
The assembly was silent. Unconsciously, they had all gradually turned their attention from Ray Diaz to the U.S. representative, who, unable to stand all the eyes on him, threw himself back into his chair and hissed,
"Get the hell out!"
Ray Diaz slowly nodded, then stood up and walked out.
"Mr. Ray Diaz, I'll take you home," Garanin said, leaving the rostrum.
Ray Diaz stood waiting for Garanin as he walked over, less nimbly than before.
"Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought you might like to get out of here, too."
The two were at the door when Ray Diaz grabbed Garanin and turned with him back toward the auditorium.
"Gentlemen, I won't miss this place. I've wasted these 2 decades, and no one here understands me. I want to go back to my homeland, back to my people. Yes, my homeland and my people. I miss them."
To everyone's surprise, the big man's eyes shone with tears. At last he said,
"I want to go back to my homeland. This is not part of the plan."
When he walked out the door of the UN General Assembly building, Ray Diaz opened his arms wide to the sun and called out with relish,
"Ah, my son!"
His 2-decade-long heliophobia had vanished. Ray Diaz's flight took off and crossed the eastern coastline to fly over the vast Atlantic Ocean. In the cabin, Garanin said to him,
"With me here, this aircraft is safe. Please tell me the location of the device you have connected to the dead man's switch."
"There's no device. There's nothing. It was just a trick to escape."
Ray Diaz took off his watch and handed it to Garanin.
"This is just a simple transmitter converted from a Motorola phone. It's not connected to my heartbeat either. It's been turned off. Keep it as a souvenir."
For a long time, neither of them spoke. Then Garanin sighed and said,
"How did this happen? The Volfacer's privilege of sealed-off strategic thinking was meant to be used against the Sophons and Tri-Solaris, but you and Tyler both used it against humanity."
"There's nothing strange about that,"
Ray Diaz said. He sat next to the window, enjoying the sunlight shining in from the outside.
"Right now, the greatest obstacle to humanity's survival comes from itself."
6 hours later, the plane touched down at Caracas International Airport on the Caribbean coast. Garanin did not get off. He would be taking the plane back to the UN. When they parted, Ray Diaz said,
"Don't abort the Wallfacer project. It really is a hope amid this war. There are still 2 Wallfacers. Please, wish them the best for me."
"I won't be seeing them either," Garanin said, with emotion.
By the time Ray Diaz walked off, leaving him alone in the cabin, he was in tears. The sky over Caracas was as clear as in New York. Ray Diaz walked down the air stair and smelled the familiar tropical atmosphere, then bent down and gave a long kiss to the ground of his homeland. Then, guarded by a large detachment of military police, he took a motorcade to the city. After half an hour on a winding mountain road, they entered the capital and drove up to the city center and Plaza Bolivar. At the statue of Simón Bolívar, Ray Diaz got out of the car and stood on the statue's base. Above him on horseback was the great armor-clad hero who had defeated the Spanish and tried to establish a unified Republic of Gran Colombia in South America. In front of him, a crowd of frenetic people boiled under the sun, swelling forward, only to be met with the vigorous resistance of the military police. Shots were fired into the air, but the tide of people eventually surged past the police line and poured toward the living Bolivar at the foot of the statue. Ray Diaz held up his hands and, with tears in his eyes, called out to the crowd in a voice dripping with emotion.
Ah! My people!
The first stone thrown by his people struck him on his outstretched left hand. The second hit him in the chest, and the third smashed into his forehead and nearly knocked him out. After that, the people's stones came like raindrops and had practically buried his lifeless body by the end. The last stone that hit Wallfacer Ray Diaz was thrown by an old woman, who struggled to carry it up to his corpse, then said in Spanish,
"Evildoer, you would kill everyone. My grandson would have been there. You'd have killed my grandson."
Then, using all the strength in her trembling hands, she slammed her stone against Ray Diaz's broken skull, where it lay exposed beneath the pile of rocks. Time is the one thing that can't be stopped. Like a sharp blade, it silently cuts through hard and soft, constantly advancing. Nothing is capable of jolting it, even the slightest bit, but it changes everything. The same year as the Mercury test, Cheng Wei-se retired. In his final media appearance, he frankly acknowledged that he himself had no confidence in victory. But this did not affect history's high opinion of the work of the Space Force's first commander. Working for so many years in a state of anxiety had damaged his health, and he died at the age of 68. The general was lucid on his deathbed and mentioned Zhang Beihai's name many times. After leaving her second term in office, Secretary General Say launched the Human Memorial Project, whose goal was the comprehensive collection of data and commemorative artifacts of human civilization that would ultimately be sent out into the cosmos on unmanned spacecraft. The project's most influential component was called the Human Diary, a website that was set up to allow as many people as possible to record their lifetimes in the form of text and images from their everyday lives, to become part of the data of civilization. The Human Diary website eventually grew to have more than 2 billion users and formed the largest ever body of information on the Internet. Later, the PDC, believing that the Human Memorial Project contributed to defeatism, passed a resolution stopping its further development and even equated it with escapism. But Say continued to pour her individual efforts into the project until she passed away at the age of 84. After retirement, Garanine and Kent made the same choice, to seclude themselves in that Garden of Eden in Northern Europe, where Luoji had lived for 5 years. They were never again seen by the outside world, and no one even knew the exact date they died. But one thing was certain, they lived a long time. Some said that the two of them reached the century mark before dying a natural death. Just as Keiko Yamasuki had predicted, Wu Yue spent the remainder of his life in depression and confusion. He worked for more than a decade on the Human Memorial Project, but was unable to find any solace in it, and he passed away in loneliness at the age of 77. Like Cheng Wei-se, Wu Yue had Zhang Beihai's name on his lips in his final moments. They pinned their shared hopes for the future on the stalwart warrior now hibernating through time. Dr. Albert Ringier and General Fitzroy both lived into their 80s and saw the completion of the 100-meter Hubble 3 space telescope, which they used to look at the planet Trisolaris. But they never again saw the Trisolaran fleet or the probes now flying ahead of it. They did not live long enough for them to cross the third patch of snow. The lives of ordinary people continued and ended as well. Out of the three old Beijing neighbors, Miao Fuchuan was the first to depart, passing away at the age of 75. He really did have his son bury him 200 meters down an abandoned mine, and his son obeyed his last wishes to blow up the mine wall and erect a tombstone to remember him. According to his father's will, the last generation before the Doomsday Battle was supposed to clear out the tombstone, and if humanity won, then it could be restored to its original location. But, in fact, less than half a century after his death, the area over the mine shaft became a desert. The tombstone disappeared, the mine's location was lost, and the Miao family's descendants couldn't be bothered to look for it. Zhang Yuan Chao died of illness like an ordinary person at the age of 80, and, like an ordinary person, he was cremated. His ashes were laid in an ordinary rectangular slot on a long rack in a public cemetery. Yang Jinwen lived till 92, and the alloy vessel containing his remains headed out of the solar system and into the vast cosmos at the third cosmic velocity. This consumed all of his savings. But Ding Yi lived on. After the breakthrough in controlled fusion technology, he turned his attention to theoretical physics, looking for ways to escape Sofon interference in high-energy particle physics experiments. He had no success. When he reached his 70s, he had, like other physicists, abandoned all hope of the possibility of a breakthrough. He entered hibernation and planned to wake at the Doomsday Battle. His sole desire was to be able to see with his own eyes the superior technology of Tri-Solaris. In the century following the start of the Tri-Solar Crisis, everyone who had lived through the Golden Age passed away. It was an era that was constantly recalled, and the old folks who had lived through those grand times chewed over their memories of it like ruminants, savoring the flavors. They always closed with one line. Ah, if only we knew how to cherish things back then. Young people would listen to their stories with a mixture of envy and skepticism. That fabled peace, prosperity, and happiness. That ideal utopia, free from care. Did it ever really exist? As the elderly passed away, the departed golden shore vanished into the smoke of history. The ship of human civilization floated alone in the vast ocean, surrounded on all sides by endless, sinister waves. And no one knew if there even was an opposite shore. Part 3. The Dark Forest. Year 205. Crisis Era. Distance of the Tri-Solaran fleet from the solar system. 2.10 light-years. Darkness. Before the darkness, there was nothing but nothingness, and the nothingness was without color. Nothing was in the nothingness. Darkness at least meant that there was space. Soon, disturbances appeared in the darkness of space, penetrating everything like a gentle breeze. It was the sensation of time passing, for the nothingness was without time. But now time took shape in a glacial thaw. Only much later was there light, at first as a shapeless blob of brightness, and then, after another long wait, the shape of the world gradually emerged. The newly resurrected consciousness struggled to make sense of it, at first managing to work out a few thin transparent tubes, then a human face behind them, which quickly disappeared, exposing the creamy white light of the ceiling. Luoji awoke from hibernation. The face reappeared. It belonged to a man with a gentle expression who looked at Luoji and said,
"Welcome to our era."
As he spoke, a field of vibrant roses flashed on his white lab coat, then gradually faded and disappeared. As he continued speaking, the coat displayed a continuous assortment of delightful images that matched his expressions and emotions. Seas, sunsets, and woods in the drizzle. He told Luoji that his illness had been cured during hibernation, and that his reawakening had gone smoothly. Recovery would take just 3 days or so, and then he would completely regain normal bodily functions. Luoji's mind, still sluggish and only partially awake, caught just one piece of information out of everything the doctor said. This was year 205 of the Crisis Era, and he had been in hibernation for 185 years. He found the doctor's accent peculiar at first, but he soon discovered that although the sounds of standard Mandarin hadn't changed much, it had been stuffed with a large quantity of English words. As the doctor spoke, the text of what he said was displayed on the ceiling, apparently through voice recognition. Perhaps to help the newly awakened better understand, the English words were replaced with Chinese characters. At last, the doctor said that Luoji could be transferred from the revival room to the general ward. His coat showed an evening scene in which a setting sun rapidly turned into a starry sky to say farewell. As this was going on, Luoji felt his bed begin to move. Just out the door, he heard the doctor call out, "Next?" Twisting his head back to look, he saw another bed enter the revival room, bearing someone who had obviously just been taken out of the hibernation chamber. The bed was quickly wheeled to a bank of monitors, and the doctor, his coat now a pure white, tapped on the wall with a finger, causing one-third of it to display complex curves and data that he began to manipulate intensely. Luoji realized that his own reawakening was probably not a major event at all, but rather just a part of day-to-day work here. The doctor was friendly, but in his eyes Luoji was nothing more than an ordinary hibernator. Like the revival room, the hallway had no lamps. The walls themselves emitted light, and although it was soft, Luoji still had to squint. But as he did so, the walls in the section of corridor he was in dimmed, and the dimmed segment followed him as his bed moved. Once his eyes grew accustomed to the light, he opened them again, at which point the hallway brightened again, remaining in his comfort zone. Evidently, the hallway's brightness adjustment system was able to monitor the changes in his pupils. Judging by that, he had to be in a personalized age. This far exceeded his expectations. As the walls passed slowly by, he saw lots of activated displays of different sizes randomly distributed on them. Some of them were moving images that he didn't have the time to look at clearly, and might have been left behind by users who forgot to turn them off. Sometimes, his automatic bed crossed paths with people walking down the hallway. He noticed that both the soles of their feet and the bed's wheels made luminous, watery waves of pressure where they contacted the ground, like what used to happen when you pressed a finger onto an LCD in his own time. The long corridor gave him an intense sense of cleanliness, as clean as a 3D computer animation, although he knew all of it was real. He moved through it with a sense of tranquility and comfort he had never known before. But what impressed him most about the people he saw was that everyone, doctors, nurses, and non-staff alike, appeared clean and elegant, and smiled warmly at him or waved when they approached. Their clothes displayed gorgeous images, a different style for each person, some abstract, others concrete. He was won over by their expressions, because he knew that the eyes of ordinary people were the best reflection of the level of civilization in a time and place. He had once seen a set of photos taken by European photographers in the late Qing Dynasty, and his deepest impression
had been of the dull expressions of the people in the photographs. Officials and commoners alike had eyes that revealed only numbness and stupidity, lacking the slightest shred of vitality. When the people of this new era looked at Luoji's eyes, they might be having the same feeling about him. The gazes that crossed his own were full of a vigorous wisdom and a sincerity, understanding, and love that he had rarely perceived in his own age. But what impressed him most was the confidence in their expressions. The sunny confidence that filled every pair of eyes had evidently become the spiritual backdrop for the people of this new era. This did not seem to be an age of despair, and that was another unexpected surprise. Luoji's bed moved soundlessly into the general ward, which held two more reawakened hibernators. One of them was lying on a bed. The other, next to the door, was packing his things with a nurse's help and seemed about ready to leave. From the look in their eyes, Luoji knew that both of them were from his own era. Their eyes were like the windows of time, and through them he had another glance of that gray era he had come from.
"How can they be that way? I'm their great-grandfather!"
Luoji heard the hibernator who was about to leave complaining.
"You can't pull seniority in front of them. It's the law. Hibernation doesn't count as age, so in the presence of the elderly, you're the younger generation. Let's go. They've waited in the reception room long enough," the nurse said.
Although she tried to avoid English words, sometimes she stumbled over Chinese words, as if speaking an ancient tongue, and was forced to use the modern language. Then the wall would display a translation into Chinese.
"I can't even understand it when they talk. All that bird speak mixed in,"
the hibernator said, as he and the nurse each picked up a bag and went out the door.
"In this age, you've got to keep learning. Otherwise, you'll just have to go live up top,"
Luoji heard the nurse say. By now, he could understand the modern language without difficulty, but he was still unclear what the nurse meant by her last sentence.
"Hello. Did you hibernate due to illness?"
the hibernator in the bed beside Luoji asked. He was young and looked to be in his early 20s. Luoji opened his mouth, but no sound came out. The young man smiled at him encouragingly.
"You can speak. Try harder."
"Hello,"
Luoji managed hoarsely. The young man nodded.
"The one who just left did. I didn't. I came here to escape from reality. Oh, and my name's Xiong Wen."
"Here. How is it?"
Luoji asked, much more easily this time.
"I don't really know. I've only been here 5 days. Still, it's definitely a good era. But for us, it's bound to be difficult to integrate into society. Mostly because we woke up too soon. A few years later would have been better."
"A few years later? Wouldn't that be even harder?"
"No. It's still a state of war now, so society can't take care of us. In a few decades, after the peace talks, there'll be peace and prosperity."
"Peace talks? With whom?"
"Tri Solaris, of course."
Shaken by Xiong Wen's final statement, Luoji strove to sit up. A nurse entered and helped him up to a half-sitting position in bed.
"They said they want peace talks?"
he asked anxiously.
"Not yet, but they'll have no other choice,"
Xiong Wen said, nimbly getting out of his bed and coming over to sit down on Luoji's. He had clearly been anticipating the pleasure of introducing someone newly awakened to this era.
"Don't you know? Humanity is amazing now. Simply amazing."
"How?"
"Our spacecraft are incredibly powerful. Far more powerful than Tri-Solaran ships."
"How is that possible?"
"Why wouldn't it be? Put the superweapons aside and look purely at speed. They can reach 15% of the speed of light, tons faster than the Tri-Solarans."
When Luoji turned a skeptical eye toward the nurse,
he noticed that she was exceptionally pretty. Everyone in this age seemed to be attractive. She nodded with a smile.
It's true.
Xiong Wen went on.
And you know how many ships there are in the space fleet? I'll tell you. 2,000. Twice as many as the Tri-Solarans. And the number's still growing.
Luoji glanced again at the nurse, who nodded.
You know how badly off the Tri-Solaran fleet is now? In 2 centuries, they've passed through the space dust they call the snow patch 3 times. I heard someone say that the most recent time was 4 years ago, and the telescope observed that their formation has become sparser. They're not holding together. More than half of the ships stopped accelerating long ago, and they decelerated considerably when they crossed the dust. They're crawling now, and they won't reach the solar system for more than 800 years. They might already be broken hulks. Projecting from their current speed, no more than 300 ships will arrive on time 2 centuries from now. However, one Tri-Solaran probe will reach the solar system soon, this year. The other 9 are following afterward, and will get here 3 years later.
The probe? What's that? Luoji asked in confusion. The nurse said,
We don't encourage the exchange of practical information. When the previous reawakened hibernator learned about these things, it took him many days to calm down. It's not conducive to recovery.
It makes me happy. So what's it to you?
Xiong Wen said with a shrug. Then he returned to his own bed to lie down. As he lay watching the soft light emitted by the ceiling, he sighed.
The kids are all right. They're really all right.
Who's a kid? The nurse sniffed. Hibernation doesn't count as age. You're the kid.
To Luoji's eyes, she actually looked younger than Xiong Wen, although he knew that his appearance-based judgment of age might not be accurate in this era. The nurse said to him,
The people from your time are all pretty despairing, but things aren't really all that serious.
To Luoji, this was the voice of an angel. He felt like he had turned into a child who had just awakened from a nightmare, and all the frightening things he had experienced were taken care of by a smile from an adult. When she spoke, her nurse's uniform shone a fast-rising sun, and under its golden light, the dry yellow earth turned green, and flowers bloomed in wild abandon. When the nurse had gone, Luoji asked Xiong Wen,
What about the Wallfacer project?
Xiong Wen shook his head in confusion.
Wallfacer? Never heard of it.
Luoji asked when Xiong Wen had entered hibernation. It had been before the Wallfacer project had started, when hibernation was very expensive. His family must have had money. But if he hadn't heard anything about the Wallfacer project in the 5 days he had been awake, that meant that even if the program hadn't been forgotten in this era, it was no longer important. Next, Luoji personally experienced the level of technology of this new age in 2 trivial areas. Soon after he entered the ward, the nurse carried in his first meal after reawakening, a very small quantity of milk and bread and jam, because his stomach functions were still recovering. He took a bite of bread and felt like he was chewing sawdust.
Your sense of taste is still recovering, too, the nurse said.
It'll taste even worse once you've recovered, Xiong Wen said.
The nurse laughed.
Of course, it's not as good as the food grown on the surface in your era.
Then where does this come from?
Luoji asked, through his full mouth.
It's produced in a factory.
You're able to synthesize grain?
Xiong Wen answered for the nurse.
There's no other option but to synthesize it. The land won't grow any crops anymore.
Luoji felt sorry for Xiong Wen. There had been people in his era who had become immune to technology and were indifferent to any sort of technological wonder, and Xiong Wen was apparently one of them. He was unable to properly appreciate this new age. The next discovery was an incredible shock to Luoji, although the thing itself was still quite plain. The nurse pointed to the cup of milk and told him that it had been put into a heating cup especially for hibernators, because the people of this era generally did not drink hot liquids. Even coffee was taken cold. If he wasn't used to drinking cold milk, he could heat it up simply by moving a slider near the bottom of the cup to the desired temperature. When he finished drinking, he inspected the cup. It looked like an ordinary glass cup, apart from a thick, opaque base which must contain the heat source. But no matter how hard he looked, he couldn't find any controls but the slider, and when he tried to twist the base, he found it was integrated with the rest of the cup.
"Don't mess around with the supplies. You don't understand them yet. It's dangerous,"
the nurse said after watching Luoji's efforts.
"I'd like to know where it gets recharged."
"Re-charged?"
The nurse awkwardly repeated the word, evidently hearing it for the first time.
"Charge. Recharge,"
Luoji said in English, but the nurse just shook her head in confusion.
"What happens when the batteries run out?"
"Batteries?"
"Batteries," he said in English. "You don't have batteries anymore?"
When the nurse shook her head again, he said,
"Then where does the electricity in the cup come from?"
"Electricity? There's electricity everywhere,"
the nurse said disapprovingly.
"The electricity in the cup won't run out?"
"It won't run out."
"It's inexhaustible?"
"Inexhaustible. How could electricity run out?"
When the nurse left, Luoji still was unable to let go of the cup. He ignored Xiong Wen's ridicule, for his surging emotions told him that he was holding a sacred object, the age-old dream of humanity, a perpetual motion machine. If humanity had really achieved inexhaustible energy, then they could achieve practically everything. Now he believed the words of the pretty nurse. Things might not be so serious. When the doctor came into the ward for a routine checkup, Luoji asked him about the Wallfacer project.
"I know of it. It's an ancient joke,"
the doctor replied offhandedly.
"What happened to the Wallfacers?"
"I think one of them committed suicide, and another was stoned to death. It all happened in the project's early days, and it's been nearly 2 centuries since then."
"And the other two?"
"I don't know. They're probably still in hibernation."
"One of them was Chinese. Do you remember him?"
Luoji ventured, staring nervously at the doctor.
"You mean the one who cast a spell on a star? I think he was mentioned in pre-modern history class,"
the nurse interjected.
"Right. And now he's..."
Luoji said.
"I don't know. I think he's still in hibernation. I don't pay much attention to that stuff,"
the doctor said absently.
"And the star? The one he cursed? The star with a planet? What happened to it?"
he asked, his heart tensing up.
"What do you think happened? It's probably still there. That spell? What a joke!"
"So nothing at all happened to that star?"
"Nothing I've heard, at any rate. You?"
he asked the nurse.
"Me neither,"
she said, shaking her head.
"The world was scared to death back then, and lots of silly things happened."
"And then?"
Luoji said with a sigh.
"Then there was the Great Ravine," the doctor said.
"The Great Ravine? What was that?"
"You'll find out later. For now, rest up,"
the doctor said with a gentle sigh.
"But it's probably better that you don't know about it."
As he turned to leave, his white coat displayed billowing dark clouds, and the nurse's uniform displayed lots of pairs of eyes, some of them frightened, some brimming with tears. When the doctor had left, Luoji sat motionless on his bed for a long while, mumbling to himself, "A joke. An ancient joke." Then he began laughing, silently at first, and then in great guffaws, trembling on his bed
and frightening Xiong Wen, who wanted to call the doctor.
I'm fine. Go to sleep, Luo Ji told him.
Then he lay down and soon fell asleep for the first time since his reawakening. He dreamed of Zhuang Yan and the child. As before, Zhuang Yan walked through the snow, the child asleep in her arms. When he awoke, the nurse walked in and said good morning to him. Her voice was soft, so as not to wake the still-sleeping Xiong Wen.
Is it morning?
Why aren't there any windows in this room? Luo Ji asked, looking around.
Any place on the wall can turn transparent, but the doctors feel that you aren't ready to look outside. It's too unfamiliar, and it will distract you and affect your rest.
I've been revived for a while now, but I still don't know what the outside world is like. This affects my rest.
Luo Ji pointed at Xiong Wen and said,
I'm not that kind of person.
The nurse laughed.
That's okay. I'm about to go off shift. Shall I take you out for a look around? You can have breakfast after you get back.
Excitedly, Luo Ji followed the nurse to the on-call room. Looking it over, he could guess what about half of the furnishings were, but he had no idea what the rest were for. There was no computer or similar equipment, but because a display could be activated anywhere on the walls, this was to be expected. Three umbrellas lined up outside the door caught his attention. They were in different styles, but from their shape, they were definitely umbrellas. What surprised him was their bulk. Weren't there folding umbrellas in this age? The nurse came out of the changing room dressed in her own clothes. Aside from the flashing movies on the fabric, changes to women's fashion in this age were well within the scope of Luoji's imagination. Compared to his own era, the major difference was their conspicuous asymmetry. He was pleased that after 185 years had passed, he could still find beauty in a woman's clothing. The nurse picked up one of the umbrellas, which must have been fairly heavy, because she had to carry it over her shoulder.
Is it raining out?
She shook her head.
You think I'm carrying an umbrella?
She said, unfamiliar with the last word.
If it's not an umbrella, then what is it?
Luo Ji pointed to the device on her shoulder, imagining that she would say some peculiar name for it. But she didn't.
It's my bicycle, she said.
When they arrived in the corridor, Luo Ji asked, Is your home far from here?
If you're talking about where I live, it's not far. 10 or 20 minutes biking, she said.
Then, standing still and fixing him with her charming eyes, she said something that shocked him.
There are no homes now. No one has them. Marriage, family, they went away after the Great Ravine. That will be the first thing you'll have to get used to.
That first thing is something I won't be able to get used to.
Oh, I don't know. In history class, I learned that marriage and family had already begun to disintegrate in your own time. Lots of people didn't want to be tied down. They wanted free lives.
This was the second time she had mentioned history class. I was like that once. But then, Luo Ji said to himself. From the moment he'd reawakened, Zhuang Yan and the child had never really left his mind. They were the desktop wallpaper of his consciousness, perpetually on display. But no one here recognized him, and with the situation so uncertain, he couldn't just rashly ask about their whereabouts, even though he was tormented by longing. They walked a ways down the corridor. Then, after they'd passed through an automatic door, Luo Ji's eyes lit up as he saw a narrow platform extending into the distance and felt fresh air blowing toward him. He sensed that he was now outside.
What a blue sky!
Was the first thing he shouted to the outside world.
Really? It can't compare to the blue skies of your era.
Definitely bluer. Much bluer. Luo Ji didn't say that out loud, just reveled in the boundless blue embrace and let his soul melt.
Then, he had a flash of doubt. Was this heaven? In his memory, he had only ever seen such a pure blue sky during the 5 years he had spent apart from the world, secluded in his Garden of Eden. But this blue sky had fewer white clouds, just a couple of pale wisps in the western sky, like someone had unintentionally left a smudge. The sun that had just risen in the east shone like crystal in the entirely transparent air, with its edge rimmed in dew. Luoji turned his eyes downward,